Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The war in Ukraine has sent shockwaves throughout the world, resulting in thousands of deaths and pushing millions of Ukrainians to flee to neighboring countries. And the Supreme Court hearing to put the first Black woman on the high court further polarized Democrats and the GOP. And the Oscars. What could possibly go wrong at the Oscars? I have two perfect guests to help me parse it all out. Dr. Jason Johnson is an associate professor of politics and journalism at Morgan State University here in Maryland. He focuses on campaign politics, political communication, strategy, and popular culture, and is a political analyst for MSNBC. And Malcolm Nance is a former Naval Intelligence and Counterterrorism Officer, a historian, and a four times New York Times bestselling author. My conversation with Jason and Malcolm is next on the Michael Steele Podcast. Well, gentlemen, welcome to the barbershop. It's great to have you up in the house today. We're going to get a little bit off the top and the sides. We're going to clean it up, particularly for our brother Malcolm, who's out there. Yeah. You know, he's out there in an undisclosed location, fighting on behalf of democracy and supporting the Ukrainian people. So we need the brother to look good. So we figured we'd take a moment and get it all cleaned up, right? Malcolm Nance, Jason Johnson, welcome.
Hey.
My barbershop visits. So Michael, I got to actually say this. So last visit to the barbershop, my barber is shaving my head and he's like, hey, so what's going to happen with Russia and Ukraine? And I told him, I was like, look, I'm not a foreign policy expert. I only have a couple thoughts. And he immediately goes into, without any prompting, he's like, well, you know, Ukraine is like one of the most corrupt countries on the planet. Why are we there? And I was like, where are you getting this from? Mm-hmm. Where I said, that comes from the same weird. And he's like, well, I'm just wondering what's the answer to the question. And I said to him, I said, you know, this is what's interesting. I said, y'all the kind of brothers that are always saying you don't trust the news, but we'll hear some crazy stuff about Ukraine from some YouTube or Instagram or TikTok site. And now you want to ask me what the truth is. It was crazy. Yeah.
And then a couple days ago, believe you,
right? And then I did not believe you,
right?
This happened. Listen, this happened to me in my barbershop in the run up to the 2020 election. No, 2016 election. And this is how it was. All these guys are sitting there like, hey, you know, Trump says, what do we got to lose? You know, and you know, he got money and he got cars. And I'm like, what the hell's wrong with y'all? Yeah. He hates Black people.
Thank you.
All right. He says it. Yes. He says it and everything. And you guys are sitting there. And you know, and I said, you know what? I actually said this on my last haircut before the election. I said, the only consolation I have with you guys is I know you don't vote. otherwise, Trump would be getting three ignorant ass votes. God almighty.
That's both of those stories are a reflection of the space we find ourselves in right now, where there is this sort of claptrap of disinformation and misinformation. The Russians and their bots have just infiltrated the system with it, and now you're finding everyday folk in the community just pushing this crazy stuff back about Ukraine and then when you confront them with the truth, rejecting the truth that you've just put in front of them for the craziness that, oh yeah, it's the most corrupt country in the world. I'm like, so Malcolm, you're there, you're in space, you're on the ground talking to people. I've seen some of your hits on MSNBC over the course of the last few weeks. Where do you give us your assessment right now of where this battlefield is and how you see the next week 2 weeks playing out. The Russians and Ukrainians are meeting this week. I don't have much faith in that because I don't think Putin really wants an end to this, not a negotiated end. What's your assessment?
Well, first off, you know, going back to that comment about Ukraine is the most corrupt nation in the world, you know, that came from the most prominent voice to say that recently was his name? Madison Cawthorn.
Madison Cawthorn, yeah.
Actually used those very words. And Marjorie Taylor Greene. And somehow that's percolating into this weird world of where extreme left, almost, you know, how can you put it? Blaxploitation level Afro in the hair wearing brothers, you know, who all believe in, who all love Shaft, right? who somehow pick up on this sort of libertarian right stuff that comes together in a horseshoe, and then they meld it all together into some weird philosophy that mixes up, you know, Nation of Islam, bean pies, and Donald Trump as all being the same or better for them. And I just don't understand it at all. So now that being said, let me recalibrate the audience. Okay, Ukraine is not the most corrupt country in the world. First off, I'm sorry, on the corruption index, Nigeria rates way higher.
Right.
You know,
right. Watch Ukraine, those emails.
You can go pass a policeman. Okay, and have them say "Dobry den," good morning, and walk about your business. You know, I've been to Nigeria. They can't figure out what tribe I'm from, so that's bad. It's not their tribe, so that's bad. And then it's like, hey, oh, you're an American, and you just see the ATM lights flash, right? Like the Bing, like 777 has comes across their eyes and they want a little something pour boire, right? Something to drink. This is not these inches that are given are not grounded in any reality,
right?
Other than what comes out of the right wing machine. And so that being said, Ukraine is a very large country. Let me make this very clear to the audience. 17 hours to drive across it end to end. If you had to drive from, the border post near Lviv all the way down to the southeast to Crimea, today it would be 20 plus hours. In the right. oldie days, which was 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, it would take you about 16, 17 hours. It's a very large country. That being said, as you know, we all know, the country was invaded by Russia. And over the last 4 weeks, Russia has met all of the predictions that I made in the run-up to the war, that Ukraine had an army. The one big thing the news media would not report on. You know, they were constantly showing news footage from the Kremlin and, you know, B-roll of guys jumping out of airplanes and modern tanks. And I kept saying, on air, you know, the Ukrainians have an army and they're pretty good. And I had gone out onto the battlefield in Donetsk with this army. And General Pavlyuk, who is the commander of the Joint Task Force at the time, who is now the commander in charge of the defense of Kyiv. General Pavlyuk was asked by one journalist from CNN, well, what happens if the Russians attack from the west, or if they attack from the north or from the south? And this guy's had Russians 210 feet to the east of him. I mean, we literally looked at them through the periscope.
It's like, you know they're right there, right?
Right.
That's what he said. He said, you know, I got him right over there.
They're right over there.
And he said, this is when I knew things were going to be bad for the Russians. He is a short little guy, you know, wrestler stature. And he goes, I don't care what direction they attack from, I'm going to fight them.
Yeah.
Wow.
Thought, oh, geez. Yeah. It harkens to that old saying, it's not about the size of the dog in the fight. It's about the size of the fight in the dog. These guys are nothing but fight Ukraine. Nothing but fight. And what you've seen in the last 4 weeks is it's not even a war. It's closer to Desert Storm. It's a savaging. of the Russian armed forces. The only problem is the Ukrainians have civilian population that are in direct line of fire. They have been attacked deliberately and relentlessly by the Russians, who are in a campaign of both ethnic cleansing and geographic cleansing, right? Mm-hmm. They're trying to, they not only want the city of Mariupol, which they have surrounded, the backside of it is on the Sea of Azov, so you can't really get out of it.
Out of it, yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's strong on all sides. So they just decided we're going to kill every person in the city. Every person, man, woman, child, until they capitulate. And they, as part of this strategy, knew they would have to raze the city to the ground and build a new ethnic Russian city there. So all of these, while all of these atrocities are going on, this interesting factor that I was actually ridiculed on air by a couple of people, where I had said very early on, we call D-Day, right? The 24th of February was D-Day. And on D plus six, that's 6 days after D-Day, I went on air with Chris Jansing and I said, the Ukrainians are gonna win this war. I'm gonna tell you right now, I'm calling it. These guys, you know, all the maps that you're showing, you know, with Clint Watts pointing out the big wide red swaths, that isn't what war.
That's not the war.
Right.
They only own the highway they are on. 1 kilometer to the right, 1 kilometer to the left, 2 kilometers in front of it. That's it. As far as their guns can shoot and the road that they're on. They own nothing else in Ukraine. Even as they occupy the cities, only the little corrals that they're in, they have. So what Russia has now is worse than a quagmire. They have multiple armies, these what we call CAAs, combined arms armies, that are in position to be cut off. The one northwest of Kyiv, remember weeks and weeks and weeks ago when I was saying they're trapped and everybody's going, oh my God, they're about to assault Kyiv. And then I would go on air and go, they're never taking Kyiv. Okay, it's literally physically the size of Chicago and has 4 million people living in it at that time. Now it's down to 2.5 million, but it's, they've got higher apartment blocks than Chicago, concrete Soviet apartment blocks ringing the city.
Yeah.
So I said, it's Stalingrad. You're never going to take the city. And they didn't. They barely touched one time in the city. And when I analyzed the attack where they came down, they were at this boulevard near the zoo, which is pretty deep into the city. Mm-hmm. I had the feeling they did that deliberately. They destroyed this armor column in a place where I would never want to be in an armor column, right? You know, 20-story skyscrapers above you with things raining down on top of you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right?
In a park to the west of you where there are people shooting up below your vehicles. It was a slaughter. And other than that, they never got further than the northwest suburbs where right now they're technically surrounded. And that's why the Russians are saying they want to draw down their operations there.
Jason,
in the south.
Yeah. First off, I appreciate this, Malcolm, because again, for me, and Michael and I were talking about this from the very beginning. You know, I always, part of authenticity is humility. And I'm like, look, I'm not a foreign policy expert. So I assiduously avoid pontificating about the war because I'm not an expert in the area. But what I have paid attention to, which is something that we sort of talked about at the beginning, is it's been interesting to watch the horseshoe left combine with the hard right in America in order to sort of rationalize what Russia is doing. And we know the Glenn Greenwalds, right? Like they're already, he's a right-wing, you know, neo-Nazi apologist. I mean, he's been doing that for years. We know the sort of Tucker Carlson's, but a lot of these other sort of left-wing folks who really don't know much more about foreign policy than the next person, you know, have this attitude that, you know, American imperialism is bad, which it is, but everybody else's imperialism is fine. No, it's not. I mean, because essentially what Russia is trying to do, they're trying to bring the old band back together. Putin's motivation seems to be, I want to recreate the old Voltron. I want to put together the old Soviet Union. And I have plenty of criticism for NATO. I have plenty of criticism for what the United States has done in Africa, what the United States has done historically. NATO does terrible imperialistic things. We don't have an issue with that. But it doesn't mean Russia ain't trying to do the same thing.
Right.
And that's what's so amazing to me that people want to forget. And it's funny, Malcolm, it goes back to 2016 because those same voices were like, oh my gosh, Russiagate is nonsense, but look at all the meddling that America does. It was like, of course America meddles in foreign elections. So do the Russians. Everybody who can do it is going to do it. Why are you pretending we're the only people who are the bad guys?
How do we flip? So you both sort of create this sort of bookend of this narrative. And for a lot of folks out there, and as Jason was saying, we were talking a little bit earlier, the foreign, just so we're clear to those listening, the foreign policy expert on this in this conversation is Malcolm, right?
Right.
I've worked in the foreign policy space on a policy side. I'm the guy in the room who's drawing up the agreements once all the fighting and shooting stops. Right. So that's what I did. I was part of the team that put together the Iranians.
I guess you can call what I do applied foreign policy.
Yeah,
there, exactly.
That's exactly right.
As military, we call it DIME in the military, diplomatic, intelligence, military, and economic. Right?
Yeah.
Or in other words, military intelligence and espionage. So,
but I'm the guy who's going to write the agreement at the end. I had a hand in drafting it, being a part of drafting the Iranians claims tribunal at the end of that crisis in the 70s and 80s. But the reality of it is, you got these bookends, and in the midst of all of this is this central figure, and the central figure is not Putin, it's Zelensky.
Oh yeah.
And it is fascinating, Malcolm, to hear you talk about the process and the progress on the ground. Right. And when you were describing that and saying Ukraine's going to win this, a lot of that for me is from the man himself, comes from the man himself, who inspires these people in a way that we have not seen since World War II. How are you assessing Zelensky in this moment relative to his counterpart, Putin, certainly, but then also Biden?
Well, right before the invasion, there was a lot of talk here about what would happen. The funny part of it is that the average Ukrainian just didn't believe it. They were saying Russia won't do it. They won't do it. While I was going, they're doing it. Okay. They are. I mean, I have received briefings from the senior ground force commander in Ukraine, General Sirsky, who said, we just don't see the formations coming together. We don't see the assault formations coming, where tanks have to be matched up with anti-aircraft units, have to be matched up with bridging equipment, mechanized infantry. And that last week before that, we saw those formations come together. Now, the average person didn't take it seriously, but the Ukrainian army took it seriously. They quietly moved themselves all over the place into position. And that's one of the few things the American public doesn't know. But one of the things that I had heard was somebody said, well, if they take Kyiv and the government moves out, they'll move out west to Lviv and they'll be like a government in exile. And if Zelensky doesn't stay or Zelensky is killed, the commander of the armed forces here, I think his name is General Zelushin, he is highly respected and he will step right into the job. And I said, I don't see that happening. I see Zelensky and his senior staff, are really hardcore, right? Ukrainians. They embody that. The Ukrainians brag that they're stubborn, and they embody that stubbornness. And, when you understand what happened here in 2014 with the Maidan uprising, how they toppled the government and got Poroshenko to leave. Yanukovych. To leave with 72 hours just on the basis of people power, that's what the Russians thought was going to happen. That the minute tanks came across that border, they would run and Russia would have this city in a day.
What was that?
One, all you gotta do is meet the Ukrainians for a minute and you will see that they were gonna fight to the death.
So,
and Zelensky was gonna be right there.
So this is the thing, I agree with this. And again, this is the political thing, Michael, that I see, mm-hmm. based on on what Malcolm is saying. This is what always occurred to me. One, it seems pretty clear, even from the outsider's perspective, that both Russia and the Biden administration thought this was going to be over in a weekend. Mm-hmm. Like they both seem to think that this was going to go very quickly. That's why Biden is scrambling around now, like, oh crap, it's been a month. Okay, right. What are we going to do? We're going
to
give them money.
I gotta find something to bring
now. I gotta do something, right? And the Russians and Putin is in the same boat of like, well, damn, I thought they were just going to roll over. And it always goes back to this sort of Air Force One philosophy in political science. This is something that I've had since I was a kid in grad school, where it's like, you try to think of, as much as we have leaders of countries, certainly democratic, semi-democratic aspiring countries, we try to think to ourselves, man, what kind of president, if shit really went down, right? If aliens attacked, if we got invaded, what president do you think would strap up and be like, yo, you know, bring it? And I remember thinking, like, you know, when I think of American presidents, if we were ever attacked by the Russians, you know, Harrison Ford, Air Force One, you know, one of his great action movies in the late 90s, I was like, Bill Clinton would never stand up to the aliens. Bill Clinton would never stand up to the Russians. You know, Barack Obama would probably try and negotiate. George Bush would, the first one. He's former CIA. George Bush would be he'd be ready to go. He'd be the last person to go down with the ship. We know Trump would have sold us out, right? Like, we know he wouldn't have done anything one way or another.
they would have 30 pieces of silver wouldn't even cover it.
It wouldn't take 30.
He'd have the full don't look up scenario. Right.
You know,
he'd be on another planet.
Yeah, he'd be out of here. And I also, and the other part of this that I never forgot when we think of foreign leaders and why people may respect them is I remember during the Iraq invasion, when the U.S. Army, you know, allied forces finally cornered Uday and Qusay in like one of Saddam's mansions, and people were playing music trying to get him out, and those guys, basically them and a couple of their friends, had a shootout with the U.S. Army for like a day and a half,
right?
And I remember thinking to myself, I was like, man, I don't think Jeb Bush would do that, right? I know that you know, looking back on it now, it's like, I know that Eric Trump and Donald Trump Jr., you know, would not be strapped in the White House being like, you're gonna have to take us alive, right? So there's something about the fantasy that we have about leaders that Zelensky represents. Everybody wants to think that their president would be Harrison Ford. Everybody wants to think that their president would be the guy from Independence Day who would be like, hey, when the chips are down, I'm going to jump into an F-15 and fight the aliens. And it's amazing to see from a purely political standpoint, because I too, just like you were saying, Malcolm, just like Joe Biden, just like Vladimir Putin, I assumed, oh man, once the bombing starts, this guy will move to Belgium and run the country in absentia. It's like, nah, Zelensky is going to be there. And I think, again, purely politically, no military, you know, no. But I think at this particular point, because he's held out so long, because Zelensky is still dropping a new mixtape every other week, still here, right? If he ever is killed, and it's over for Russia.
It's over.
You're right about that. I kept using this phrase in a couple of podcasts, and I said, what people don't understand, I think, Jason, we talked about it one time, where I kept saying, you guys need to start incorporating this phrase into your vocabulary, white Taliban, okay? These people will go on jihad when Russia crosses that border. And we're there. The IEDs are starting up in very large quantities. Farmers are out raiding at night, shooting up convoys. Russia controls nothing other than the city of Kherson, and that's now contested. They went from solidly holding that, but very early on, and I had some fights with good friends of mine, you know, some of whom are on air, who are intelligence people, saying it's going to be over in 72 hours in Kyiv. And I go, you've never been to Kyiv. Okay, I said this phrase, and believe it or not, in a week, these things will probably have to be put away. I said that Kyiv will become the largest Molotov cocktail party since Stalingrad. But the Russians never got anywhere near the city to where people could whip out their Molotovs. Mm. Nowhere. And people are heartfully disappointed there.
I'm sure they are, right? Grandma's got all these bottles sitting in over in the corner. She's right. Like, where they at?
Literally hundreds and thousands of them sitting at checkpoints.
What do you make of? So I've got a two-parter here. So I've got one for Jason and one for you, Malcolm. The one for Jason is, I love your mixtape analogy because it makes a lot of sense and it is so Zelensky, right?
Yeah.
But you saw President Biden this week in his speech at NATO in Poland, which was very good. It was good on a whole number of levels. I love the interaction with the people. But to me, the most authentic moment, that mixtape moment for him where he kind of mixed it up, was when he said, yeah, Putin needs to go. And everybody lost their shit over that. Mm-hmm. And the White House immediately started backpedaling. And I'm like, no, we all sitting out here thinking the exact same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
The Ukrainians absolutely are thinking that. So for you, Jason, how do you assess Biden's mixtape on that note? The whole backdrop of Poland, his being there, and then, you know, the script thing is one thing, but I can tell you as a political operative and a principal in politics from time to time, when you had that moment where you drop the thing that's not on the script, the Reagan, you know, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall kind of moment, it changes the nature of the game.
There are a couple of things that the Democrats as a whole, I know we'll end up talking about this, but Biden, there are a couple of things that the Democrats as a whole totally have going for them as far as public sentiment that they seldom capitalize on. And this is one of them. Like, this is a war that the vast majority of the American people clearly see a good guy and a bad guy.
Right.
There's a charismatic leader that people can revolve around. It's a bunch of white folks. So a lot of white people in America aren't upset. I know people all over who are like, I would love a Ukrainian family to come stay with me, right? They're not saying that about Yemenis. They're not saying that about Somalians, right? So we you know,
Jason. Jason, what did I say?
I love a Ukrainian family. Yeah, okay. I got a few Somalis.
What did I say 4 weeks ago on air? I said the moment that they start seeing dead white children and grandmothers, the entire sentiment of this war will change.
Yeah, I mean, Malcolm said this. People like, so you've got quote unquote, and I use this term, you know, cynically in the PR. Political communication way, you got a good war. You should be milking it. Biden should be talking about this all the time, right? Like, you should be connecting this more aggressively to Trump's impeachment.
Yeah,
to
but like, people are concerned about inflation, Jason. Yeah, people are more concerned about inflation, brother.
See, here's the problem with that. Here's the other thing that they have in their favor that they should be talking about more. As angry as people are about inflation, and I maintain this, and you've probably heard me say this, Michael. I don't know if Malcolm's ever heard me say this. The biggest issue about, let's talk gas prices specifically.
Right.
People aren't angry specifically about high gas prices. They're angry about volatility.
Yeah.
That has always been the issue. I don't like it when my gas prices go up, right? But what really pisses me off is not that gas moved to $5.50, right? But because if it moves to $5.50 and I hate it, but it stays there for the entire summer, I can budget for that. What pisses me off is when I go to the gas station near my house on Friday, on Sunday to get my gas for the week, it goes from $5.50 to $5.80 to $4.75 to this. When it's volatile, that's when people get pissed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's the political damage that the Democrats should be talking about in a more effective way. People can handle, it's not fun, it's not easy, but people can handle certain levels of inflation. What they don't like is volatility and inconsistency. But again, we'll maybe address this later. I mean, we also have a Congress that just gave an additional $31 billion to the military budget so we can throw it across the world, but didn't want to give people $2,000 a month to stay home for 6 months and have rent relief and a rent moratorium during a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. So I'm the last person to say that our government under Joe Biden or Joe Manchin has any degree of common sense.
I saw what you did there.
Yeah.
I saw what you did there.
How we should be spending our money.
So Malcolm, this one's for you. So going back to the big board that our buddy Clint Watts stands in front of, and actually does a very effective job of sort of helping us visualize the movements. Yeah. The other day, he was talking about the next part of this potentially, and the river, I forget, that runs from north to south, that cuts basically
the
long
river.
What was that?
The Dnieper River.
Correct.
D-N-I-P-R.
So the idea now that's floating around in policy, diplomatic, and some military circles is a Korean style solution where you've got a North Korea, South Korea, and you'll have a North Ukraine, a Southern Ukraine. Right. So Russia will just claim everything, Donbass, and all of the southern portion, and you know, Zelensky and the crew will be able to keep the North, because that's the off ramp from what some are saying that Putin is looking for at this point, given pretty much everything you just described for us.
Right.
Well, you know, it would be an interesting scenario if there was, in fact, a gains by Russia to an actual 38th parallel, right? Like the Chinese and North Korea did. They're nowhere near that. Nowhere near that. They're nowhere near dividing the East from the West country, which was one of the original war plans. Phase one, I had actually assessed phase one was that border area that they now occupy. Actually, they're only occupying a fraction of what I predicted. Phase two would have been the Dnieper River, would have been where they would have phased all the way in and then started taking the bridge crossings at Kremenchuk and the city of Dnipro itself, and moving from the south from Odessa. None of that has happened. So they don't even have enough territory to make a new, you know, to make a South Korea, North Korea analogy.
Wow.
They failed so badly at Donetsk and Luhansk that the areas that were reinforced since 2014, the Joint Task Force area. Right. Everyone thought that the move through Kherson and the, you know, the land bridge and coming up near Zaporizhzhia would be them cutting behind them and going in to Kramatorsk and cutting them off from the rear. And it looked good, except all of their combat power was spent almost instantly once they made that move up north from Kherson. That area has not lost any terrain. The one place that you thought they would have lost it would have been retaking the remainder of Donetsk province and Luhansk province. That is solid. There's that 70-meter checkpoint I was talking to you about, still in their control.
And the Ukrainians are clawing back territory that was lost to the Russians.
Yeah, if I were you, I would stop using the word claw. What they are doing is, this isn't clawing back like they're just desperately trying to get it. These guys
are just taking it back.
Yeah,
they're just taking it back. And some of the categorizations that you hear in the news media are laughable. Like, you know, they're making gains. Hey, I knew this was going to happen. So, Emily, and when all of these gains that they're making happen, they happen in a very, very, it's air raid.
Wow.
So I knew this would happen in the middle of this recording. So I said, there's no way I'm going to hide where I am now, right? So those gains that they're making are the army that was supposed to have shattered in the first 72 hours. That army is extant. All of those combat organizations remain, and they are actually maneuvering around and defeating the Russians on the battlefield. If they continue the way they're going right now, and I made this prediction just a couple of days ago, they could completely relieve Kyiv of all Russian forces in a week.
Wow.
And, you know, to the point where Kyiv will be out of all danger. And that's why Russia came to the table today saying, we're going to pull back on those combat operations.
Can we have a conversation?
Right.
Can we talk now?
I mean, I don't want to hurt y'all no more. So, I mean, if y'all ready for me to be done.
Yeah, y'all ready for me to talk?
Right, right.
It's quite possible that the Ukrainians, before these negotiations are over, could have that entire army surrounded and surrendering.
Wow.
And that would be a moment. West of Kyiv.
Yeah.
So we're gonna take a quick break. Folks, we just ran through Ukraine and that story. You know why Malcolm was such a critical part of this conversation, because he's given us perspectives that I don't think a lot of us have had about what's really happening there. When we come back after the break, we're gonna bring it home a little bit. And we're gonna talk about the week that was for the Supreme Court and what the hell happened at the Oscars. More of the Michael Steele podcast right after this.
The Sports Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
Hi, this is Harry Littman, former United States Attorney, current LA Times legal affairs columnist, and creator and host of the Talking Feds podcast, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day, from voting rights.
Voting in our country has a specific racial connotation and a racial history, and one in which it has been fundamentally about moving away from exclusion and at a snail's pace.
To the January 6th Select Committee.
We're going to see almost every actor who's culpable in this refuse the subpoena.
To U.S. national security and foreign relations.
I served in the FBI in the aftermath of 9/11, and I've seen what happens when there's boots on the ground.
To anything and everything at the Department of Justice.
The hardest thing about coming into the Department of Justice, it's not like everything hits reset. There are court proceedings and investigations that are all midstream, and you don't control when you get to make a decision on those.
To hear roundtable discussions with the country's most prominent voices from government, journalism, and law. Follow us wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. We're having an incredible conversation here at the barbershop with my buddy Malcolm Nance and Dr. Jason Johnson. So, Jason.
Wait.
Uh-oh.
Is Jason smart brother? And I'm just undercover brother.
You undercover brother.
I mean, but who's conspiracy brother is actually what I want to know. I need to know who's conspiracy brother is.
Michael's conspiracy brother.
Yeah, right. I can play a good conspiracy if you want me to.
No, conspiracy brother's coming in too. Don't worry. He'll be responding to me.
Right.
So Jason, we watched an incredible display of poise. Intellect, determination that was laced at time to time with the look.
Right.
And every black man in America knows what that look is like.
Yep. If you were raised by black people, yes.
When the woman looks at you with that look, you're like, oh, hell, I just stepped all up in it, right? Mm-hmm. So you had that this week with Judge Ketanji, Brown Jackson and her hearing for the Supreme Court. You also had Republican senators who at the outset claim, we don't want to make this into what happened to Judge Kavanaugh, mm-hmm. and then proceeded to try to turn it into a shit show. What's your assessment of that hearing process that we witnessed this week?
You know, it was kind of offensive to me. And it wasn't offensive because of how the Republican senators behave or how feckless some of the Democrats were, except for Cory Booker. It was offensive to me because it is a reminder, and I've pointed this out in a couple of occasions, it was a reminder of how broken and how little integrity our system has now. You know, the Supreme Court is at its lowest approval ratings in the history of measurement, right? Yeah. Like the Supreme Court approval rating from Americans is hovering between 37 and 40%, right? absolutely terrible for the court that's supposed to be the final word on our Constitution and the law of the land. And why is that? Well, it's because everybody, even the casual observer, has seen that the whole process is completely corrupted. You had a stolen seat with Merrick Garland. I tell you guys, when more people watch the Kavanaugh hearings than watch Benghazi hearings. I remember my students were watching Kavanaugh and being like, this guy sounds terrible with the crying and the beer and the sexual assault and then the mysterious money that gets paid off. And then you had Amy Comey Barrett, who couldn't answer questions to the second year law student. I thought Harriet Meyer was the most incompetent, person I had ever seen in a legal position from a Republican administration. And then we had Amy Comey Barrett. So when you see that the entire process is just, do you have the numbers and are you the guy running the White House? Nobody respects it anymore. So what I saw was a sham process as part of a highly compromised democratic system that we're now trying to prop up. And when I see Republican senators who were literally allegedly in cahoots, were trying to overthrow this country, sitting here questioning a woman who will one day be the final arbiter of how our law works, it's a sham. It is an absolute shame. I was offended in some respects by some of the coverage that tried to pretend that this was an actual process. It is not a process anymore. We need massive reform in how our Supreme Court operates. We need massive reform in how Supreme Court justices are selected and put into office. I have said, we all know our brilliant friend Ellie Mistel. I have been arguing for years that the rules should be, there should be constitutional rules, but Joe Biden would never have the political will or interest in doing this. The constitutional rule should be, hey, if there's an opening on the Supreme Court, there has to be a vote within 90 days. And if you can't figure out if the Senate and the House, if the Senate can't agree on who the president appoints, then you get to stick the person on the seat for a year. Fine, we're going to have to revisit this year. No more of this nonsense where Mitch McConnell can say, I'm not going to vote on the person that you like. Right. And there should be ways in which, and yes, it should be limited to 30 years on the bench. And yes, Clarence Thomas should be impeached, but watching people question Ketanji, Judge Jackson, question her integrity, question her intelligence and question her ability in the same week that we have Clarence Thomas, who has basically been trying to cover for his wife, who's playing footsie with insurrectionists, and we're supposed to take this process seriously. This is some end of Rome level garbage. And I was bothered throughout the entire hearings last week.
Malcolm, how do you see it from where you're sitting?
Yeah. And the fact that I actually had to watch this from the other side of the ocean and watch this humiliating display of, first off, you're right, the treason weasels who were all took part in the attempt to bring down the government. Yeah. Ted Cruz, all of these people spouting these conspiracy theories were absolutely the most bonkers part of it. And, Judge Brown, I suspect, actually had to sit there, and this had to be going through her head. 1 hour, 27 minutes, I'll be a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
1 hour, 26 minutes, I'll be a Supreme Court justice. I will put up with these idiots for another hour or whatever it was. The patience of Job, how she did that, I would have popped off it every time. I would have said, I'm more qualified than him. I'm more qualified than him. I'm more qualified than any four justices. Because as you all know, you have to be three times, twice as good to go half as far. So if you want to go the whole way, you got to be four times as good, and then you still won't make it. So, I'm just so happy and relieved that Joe Manchin decided he was going to throw his lot in with the Democratic Party. But you know what? The deal isn't done yet. Because I haven't heard what Kyrsten Sinema is going to do since she's a acting Republican these days. And, she's just the kind of person that would put a knife in it at the last moment.
I think that Jackson, you got to remember that they pointed out that like a bunch of these Republicans actually voted for her last promotion,
right,
which was less than a year
ago. Right.
Like I never thought her getting on the bench was really in question. And part of what bothers me, like I said, because I think it's a sham process. We have to stop pretending that processes that are inherently corrupt are somehow reflections of the strength of our government. We can't do that anymore. We can't cover elections the way we used to with the kind of voter suppression laws, because what you do is you give these corrupted systems the patina of legitimacy and authenticity, and they are not. But when I also thought about it from this perspective, if you handed out a secret ballot to the Senate, and it's almost like giving a pretest as a professor, handed out a secret ballot to the Senate. Everybody put out their votes. Then we're going to put it in a lockbox, right? And then we're going to compare it to the final vote after her confirmation hearings. It's going to be the same numbers. No one has changed their mind. No one's mind has been changed in any of this. And I said last week, you know, I was old. I am old enough to remember.
I get to say this to you guys.
Oh, you've reached that point? I remember the Clarence Thomas hearings, because at the time I was a kid. And my parents, we were going on vacation to, we were living in Nebraska, and my parents wanted to take us to see Mount Rushmore. So we're in the car driving from Nebraska to North or South Dakota. It's 10, 12 hours in the car. And of course, there's no Sirius XM. There's no satellite radio. It's the 90s. And so all that we could get was NPR. So we were in the car during the hearing. So I listened to hours and hours and hours of the hearings, right? It's like burned into my brain. And so, of course, I remember being, you know, listening to the moment where Clarence Thomas says this is a high-tech lynching of an uppity black man. And I said that what we saw with Judge Jackson, it wasn't a lynching, because with Thomas, there really was some question as to whether he was going to get on, right? Like that was back in the day when you didn't know how these votes were going to go. It really was, people really were making up their minds depending on what happened in the testimony. So because Judge Jackson getting on has just been a known thing, I don't think it was ever at risk. What we saw was a flogging. It was just a public beating of a qualified black woman, as Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Marsha Blackburn were like, well, we know we can't stop this black lady from getting on, so we're just going to flog her publicly, right, you know, so that our racist constituents can get off on seeing this black woman be abused. That's what it was. It was deeply, deeply offensive from a racial and a sort of justice and human rights standpoint, above and beyond the fact that it's a corrupted system.
I want to listen to take a little bit and soak in probably to your point, Jason, about flogging. I like that analogy, because that actually speaks to what we saw more appropriately. But then there was the moment after the flogging with Cory Booker, mm-hmm. who basically took the shawl and wrapped her in it, you know, sort of collectively representing a lot of Americans who mm-hmm. watched this hearing. Let's see if we can get a little bit of what Corey said.
I'm telling you right now, I'm not letting anybody in the Senate steal my joy. I told you this at the beginning. I'm embarrassed. It happened earlier today. I just look at you and I start getting full of emotion. I'm jogging this morning and I'm at the end of the block I live on. And I can tell, because I put my music on loud and I'm jogging, trying to block out the noise of the heart attack I'm having. And this woman comes up on me, practically tackles me, an African-American woman. And the look on her eyes, she just wanted to touch me, because I think because I'm sitting so close to you, and tell me what it meant to her to watch you sitting where you're sitting. And you did not get there because of some left-wing agenda? You didn't get here because of some dark money groups? You got here how every black woman in America who's gotten anywhere has done by being, like Ginger Rogers said, I did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards in heels.
He captured the moment in a way that I think lifted everybody who watched what happened to Ketanji that week, because I think a lot of people were rooting to, back to the first point you made, Jason, about the process. I think a lot of people were rooting for as close to a fair process as we could get. Mm-hmm. And when we couldn't even get close to that, there was just sort of this sense of frustration and anger and hopelessness on the one hand, but then they would look at her when she would take on directly the challenge to her integrity, her authenticity, her jurisprudence, and we would be lifted. So Corey at the end just sort of brought that warm blanket to the conversation in a way that was missing throughout the week. And I really appreciate the brother for that. And, you know, people, you know, have whatever they want to say about Corey and the moment and all that. But for me, it brought it home for me in a very authentic way, I thought. How did you guys see it?
Yeah, I think the same. I feel the same way. I thought that speech was beautiful. And when I heard it again, when you play it, I even more beautiful, because I really feel the sentiment. There are those people that you meet every once in a while. When my children went to school at Benjamin Banneker High School in DC, I met the principal one day, and she was such a commanding presence. I literally sat up straight in my chair.
That's saying something if you sat up straight.
Exactly.
I thought, this woman is all business, right? And I need to respect that. And I know that's Judge Jackson, because she just went through this.
Yeah.
And now she has to go through this dog and pony show again, and she will make history. That being said, I do have to make a quick aside about Clarence Thomas. Are we going to talk about him?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, whatever you want, baby. It's Power Shot.
My beloved late mother, who was just an angel. She loved everybody. But God forbid you mention Clarence Thomas in her presence. You know? She's from South Carolina, born in the 30s. You know, she has some pretty clear views about certain types of people that live in certain houses. Mm-hmm. So she would just get upset during that whole process with Anita Hill. And then years later, she would just go, there's always one that will sell us out. There's always one. And I've since transported that into the phrase, slave catchers always brought one with them that to trick you into coming out of hiding and to be caught. And that's Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas is the worst. First off, he might arguably be one of the worst justices in American history.
Right.
Second, now that this scandal with his wife, who everyone has known. I actually ran into them one time in Northern Virginia, going into a sporting goods store, both of them coming out. And I tell you, I'm going to be honest with you, since we're on a podcast and I can be frank these days, I wanted to spit on him because I understood what he represented, which was he hated the 42 million African-Americans he represented. He was not Thurgood Marshall. Okay.
Right.
I mean, Thurgood Marshall has a really nice statue. I argue there will never be a Clarence Thomas statue ever. So, you know, but with the corruption with his wife, who was literally plotting to overthrow the government of the United States, and who was in, you know, cuckoo la la land with the conspiracy theories that the entire United States government was about to be arrested and thrown onto barges in Gitmo is crazy. And we have to act like it's normal and she has to be treated with dignity. I don't recall them treating Hillary Clinton with dignity when she was the first lady. I don't recall them treating Michelle Obama with dignity. Why suddenly is she untouchable? If of all things, she should be really held up to the, you know, what do they say, right? Caesar's wife. Not in this case.
And in fact, I mean, there's talk now that she will get a subpoena.
I don't care at this point. Merrick Garland hasn't done a damn thing.
Well,
Merrick Garland has not been remotely aggressive enough in addressing any of this. We're basically past the window of being able to change most of these court rulings, these feckless, impotent court cases that he has put out there against voter suppression in Georgia and different kinds of states. They're not going to be effective enough to do anything by the midterm elections. And all of these people are going to get off scot-free. 50 years from now, if we're not all in freaking gulags, they're going to talk about the absolute incompetence, lack of urgency, and lack of agency that was demonstrated by the Biden administration in his first year and a half when he had some semblance of a chance to protect American democracy.
And a mandate
to protect American democracy. So when you see people like Jenny Thomas and you see people like Clarence Thomas, in fact, the evolution of Clarence Thomas with his wife is a demonstration of what happens when you allow these kinds of quislings to have positions of power, when you allow these kinds of people who are willing to sell out principles in order for power and access to continue to be there. Clarence Thomas has not just not been a good judge because I disagree with his rulings. He has also written some of the fewest, smallest rulings. Like, he hasn't been a particularly good justice. Nobody is in law school writing their papers on him right now. Nobody's writing books about his jurisprudence because he hasn't been impressive. He should not be on the court at this point, not because of what his wife does, but because of what he is aware that his wife has done, that he has actually voted in ways that would protect her for the positions that she was taking, for the people that she was connected with. Every single freaking person on the planet knows that. And I'll go back to what you said initially, Michael, about Cory. Look, again, I think what Cory Booker did was great. One thing that I told people who were somewhat cynical about it is like, I don't know Cory at all. Like, we've talked a couple of times.
Right.
Everyone who I know who knows him personally, and I kept telling people this, everybody who I know who knows him personally is like, nah, he's kind of this way all the time. Like it's right. That's not a show for him.
Yeah, I know him personally. It's not a show for him. Yeah.
Yeah, he's really that person behind the scenes. Like, I've been on private Zooms with him in a couple situations I was in. It's like, oh yeah, he is kind of that guy. And so it was appreciated. It was kind, it was strategic. I mean, like, Judge Jackson just needed a break.
Yeah.
But again, it goes to the fact that it's kind of like I said this years ago about taking a tour of the British Museum. And I was like, taking a tour of the British Museum is validating a thief's behavior. We shouldn't do things like this. This is all stolen goods from different parts of the world that they did when they were in the Imperial Empire. Covering a corrupted and dysfunctional process for selecting a new justice validates a process that should no longer be validated. And that's ultimately, you know, what my big concern is. It's great that people said kind things about her. It's great that she's going to get through. She's still only going to be one justice out of nine, where it's still a 6-3 because the Trump administration basically stole three of them. And on top of all of that, given the kinds of rulings and cases that we will be seeing over the next year and a half, the Supreme Court is absolutely compromised in a way that we have never, ever seen before. And we have an administration that is dead set against doing anything. They won't do court expansion. They won't even consider term limits. They're not doing a damn thing to ensure our democracy by shoring up or protecting or reeling in what is a thoroughly compromised part of our government.
I think the last point on that before we shift to something really fun is... I'm surprised the Biden administration has not operated as if this is the only time they will ever have to make the changes that you've outlined. Yeah. Whether I agree or disagree with them or not is irrelevant. What's relevant is whether or not the administration believes that these changes are fundamental to protecting democracy and advancing its cause. And if that is the case, then you move hell and high water to make that happen. You know, or is it heaven and high water? You use heaven and high water to make that happen. And that's not been the case. I look at this DOJ, I look at Merrick Garland, and I shake my head and go, dude, do you know not why you're there, but what you're supposed to do in the job? I mean,
yes.
I mean, I think most of us can smell criminality, right? We see criminality. We watch this process unfold in front of us real time. Don't sit there and tell me you can't make a friggin' case. What are you waiting for?
You have
and
all
hell, even if you don't think you have all the dots, all the I's dotted and the T's crossed, put that shit out there and see what happens, because you never know.
And this is, and I got to add to this before we go to the key thing, which we'll be paying attention to. I have to add to this, Michael, there are political consequences for that as well.
Yes.
And not just political consequences as far as what happens in this fall's election, but what the Democrat, what the Democratic leadership has consistently failed to understand is that you do have a part of your base. You do, you know, the Democratic base is made up of lots of different kinds of people. You got your white folks in the suburbs, you got your Latinos, you have your Southwestern people, you have Black folks in different parts of the country. All these constituents want different things. But there is a through line of the sort of primary activist constituency in the Democratic Party, including some independents who are like, we want you to hold the people who tried to overthrow our government accountable. And you're not doing it.
You're not doing
we got
it.
Punched in the face. We got punched in the face. Jason, and they're not doing anything about it.
To your point, I tell Democrats, I remind them, y'all know what's about to happen on the first Tuesday of November. You are about to lose the House. And when you do lose the House, what the hell do you think happens the day, not the day after, the day Kevin McCarthy takes that gavel? What do you think happens? This commission goes away.
Right.
Investigations into Hunter Biden, investigations into the January 6th commission members, starting with Liz Cheney and Kevin Kinzinger.
Right.
What do you think happens here? So you've got a very narrow window to make the case to the American people that the last administration was not only corrupt in its disregard for the rule of law and the Constitution, but actively sought to overturn the duly elected election results.
You know, I've said it 100 times, Jason. Jason, I don't know if you've heard me say it, but you made a prediction last March that if the Republicans take the House, they will elect Donald Trump Speaker of the House, and that they will do it to humiliate the position of Nancy Pelosi in the way that they've humiliated the position Barack Obama held. And then they'll do impeachments every week from that point onward.
Every week.
You know, this is a 20 alarm fire for democracy. We have an opportunity with Ukraine because their Putin love is now being exposed.
Right.
And as you said, on a political level, they should be attacking on that. You are a Putin lover. You helped cause this. We have the Republicans now saying Joe Biden is responsible for the invasion of Ukraine. Joe Biden is weak and feckless. It's just against who? The guy whose butt you were literally kissing or who were taking money from in many instances? You know, and were, you know, a president that was literally his sock puppet. It's just utterly amazing to me. We are standing on the cusp of the end of democracy in a couple of places. Ukraine, it is absolutely must hold here. All right. And that's why absolutely cannot fall. And it ain't gonna. It's just a question of whether it gets so bad, chemical weapons come into it, and we go to war over this, real war.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and then comes November, first week of November. Who are the, you know, I asked this in a tweet recently. Who are these Democrats that hate Joe Biden that brings him into the low 30s? Because it's just Democrats.
Well,
he should be in the mid 60s, and there's like 30-40% of Democrats suddenly hate Joe Biden and hate his approval.
But
his approval rating down.
Here's why Joe Biden's approval ratings are so low. Yes, blah, blah, blah. We have inflation, blah, blah, blah. They're sort of structural things. But what you have, it is, I almost say this is, you know, you guys have, you know, both of you guys have been blessed to have wonderful wives in your lives. You know, I love your wife, Marie, Malcolm. I have not been married, but I can say this for my married friends and married guys that I know. It's like, you may have a low approval rating from your wife, right? But she ain't trying to choose nobody else either. She'll still stack you up against, she still would choose you over. So Democrats, they're disappointed in Joe Biden the way your wife could be disappointed in you. It doesn't mean they want to be with anybody else.
No, there was a dinner where I was a little bit suspicious, but I get your point.
So Democrats, they're not abandoning Joe Biden for Republicans. They're disappointed in the stuff that he hasn't done that they thought he would do. The numbers that he has right now are unsustainable. Right. You can't be a Democrat. You can't run as a Democrat when the head of your party's approval rating with African Americans is in the mid 60s. That's not sustainable. You can't run as a party as a whole if your leadership numbers are, you know, somewhere in the 50s or something else like that. Like he's got low poll numbers because the symbolic things that he could have done, i.e. doing something about police violence, doing something about the insurrections, the big symbolic stuff that would have made people happy, they didn't do it. The practical stuff, they kept the country afloat, but they didn't do enough extra stuff. Like I said, giving people $2,000 a month for 6 months and then having rent relief or an eviction moratorium, keep that crap for 8 months. Just right. And make it consistent, and it's right. Fine, because I promise you those same people are hearing about Tom Brady getting PPP loans and all these companies right. getting money from the previous administration. It's like, well, I didn't get any of that stuff. I was kicked out of my house and the restaurant right. that I work at is closed. So they have failed at the symbolic things, and then their policies have not been as transformative as they needed to be for people to be happy with the administration. And I think that was always going to be a danger about Joe Biden, that he wasn't creative enough from the policy standpoint, that you can't take people back to the good old days because the good old days are gone. And now you're in a situation where no matter what he does, unless he wants to make some serious bold decisions one way or another, he ends up dragging down his party. And I'm my sadness is that it didn't have to be this way. He could have done a better job. And he's here on a gold mine of policies that he could be making the most of.
But the problem, Jason, is Democrats don't know how to do politics, baby.
Well, no, they still
fundamentally don't understand how I whipped their ass in 2010. They just don't get how you could win against a president who's sitting there at 60% in the polls. So what the hell do you think is going to happen against a president who's sitting at 30% in the polls?
We're gonna take a quick break. We'll be right back right after this.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I'm Rick Smith, host of The Rick Smith Show. Are you tired of the corporate-controlled media ignoring the needs of we the people? You know, the people who actually do the work? Are you tired of the platitudes that they throw at us? Remember when they called us patriotic, frontline heroes, essential, only to find out that they've lined their pockets with the fruits of our sacrifice and labor? Had enough? It's time to come together, organize, and unite. Join us at The Rick Smith Show daily by downloading the podcast each and every day. Subscribe so you never miss a minute. The Rick Smith Show podcast is found wherever you get your podcasts, from iTunes to iHeart, Stitcher to Podbean, and beyond. Go to TheRickSmithShow.com for more information on how you can get the podcast each and every day. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steele Podcast. So let me let you guys get up out this chair because we're about to pay rent on this barbershop in a moment. We let you guys get it. So the pièce de résistance this week was I sat down. I was out at a Wizards game and on Sunday, and it was great. You know, Wizards beat the Warriors. Loved the moment. It was really good. Got a little bobblehead brought home. It was really kind of cool. So I'd come in and I flip on the Oscars. You know, I wasn't all. I was kind of yawn about the Oscars this year because, you know, A, movies, B, Oscars. So, but you know, I'm in the kitchen and I'm about to get my little G&T on, you know, my little gin and tonic, trying to kind of settle down. And I look up and Chris Rock had just told a joke about, you know, G.I. Jane, and everybody laughed, including Will Smith. And next thing I know, I saw Will walking up on the stage and I was like, oh, okay, what's this? This is a little different. Okay, is this scripted? What's going on? And then I watch him smack the shit out of Chris Rock, go back to his seat, and then all of a sudden the sound went off. The camera started jerking around. Will Smith is sitting there screaming. And, you know, later find out he's telling, keep my wife's name out of your effing mouth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What the hell was that all about? Now, you guys, you guys captured in tweets for me the moment. And so I'm going to start with Jason, one of the tweets that you put out. First off, no way Will Smith does that to a white comedian. A Bill Burr or Ricky Gervais, he wouldn't have been able to reach the stage. He definitely wouldn't have been asked he would have been asked to leave afterwards. And both of those comedians would just be as likely to make that joke. You then went on and you tweeted, it's been funny watching right-wingers desperately try to engage about Will Smith, Chris Rock, because their business model is built on antagonizing Black people and grievance. I don't even know if this guy, but his bad faith, one of the people you were talking about on my tweet, has all the hallmarks of that shtick. So you could see this sort of immediate visceral reaction from the public, where some tried to seize it as some type of political statement, which, okay, let's set that bullshit aside because they ain't nothing to do with that.
No.
Your first tweet, though, was really about a very interesting moment, because I agree with you. There's no way in hell Will Smith walks up on that stage and smacks a white comedian.
No.
It does not happen.
It doesn't happen. He doesn't get to the stage, Michael. He doesn't get to the stage. Security would have seen him and said, oh, hell no. You're not getting to the stage. We're not allowing this to happen. And if he somehow got to the stage, they would have asked him to leave. And I think it's important, you know, Gwen Ifill, the brilliant, you know, capable lawyer Gwen Ifill responded and said, well, if we're going to have an interracial conversation, you know, Chris Rock doesn't make that joke about a white woman. I disagree. If Scarlett Johansson,
I disagree too. I think he does.
Yeah. If Scarlett Johansson had shaved her head and was sitting next to, and we've got to remember, Chris did not know. He has said that he did not know that Jada Pinkett had alopecia.
I didn't know.
I didn't know either. Right. Like there's some real two Americas
not
about
my
this.
News of the day.
Exactly. I was completely unaware of this. So if Scarlett Johansson had a shaved head sitting next to Colin Jost and Chris Rock had said, dang, Scarlett Johansson went from the Black Widow to the next white Dora Milaje, right? Like if he says something like that, that's totally the kind of joke that Chris Rock would make.
Yeah.
Okay. And so, no, I what deeply offends me about what I saw, and I'm like you, Michael. I was in the car coming back from wine tasting with some friends of mine, and my friend in the back of the car, she's like, something crazy just happened at the Oscars. Like, we weren't paying attention. We had been wine tasting all day. I don't even drink. I was just there to hang out with friends.
Right.
And what bothers me about this is that, to me, what I saw is just textbook quintessential toxic masculinity.
Can I real quick to your point? Let's do. You said in a tweet, a lot of people out there telling on themselves as they try to rationalize a performance of toxic masculinity into an act of love or protection.
Exactly. What I saw was a man go up there because his ego was smirched, his self-esteem was in question, and he decided to engage in a violent act to protect his own ego. Toxic masculinity teaches men that your honor, your position, your integrity is constantly under assault, and therefore anybody who attempts to smirch it or touch it, you have to respond violently and publicly. That's the thing that tells you if somebody smudges my sneakers at the store, I got to punch him. That's what somebody tells you if this guy looks at my woman the wrong way at a movie theater, I got to pull a gun. That's what tells you if you get cut off on the highway, mm-hmm. you got to chase him down to the gas station and beat him up. That is toxic masculinity. It tells us that violence is how we have to respond to any perceived insult and smudge. And the reason I have a problem with it and led to that tweet is because to me, Michael, and to me, Malcolm, that same toxic masculinity, that same energy that led to Will Smith doing what he did, it's the same energy that leads to violence against women. Because if you think I have to respond to this man insulting me by going up and smacking him, that's the same energy that says this woman disrespected me, so I have to hurt her.
Yep.
And you had a lot of women out there and some men, people who I respect, who I was really shocked and disappointed, to be perfectly candid, who were like, I'm so happy to see somebody protecting an African-American woman. I was like, this is toxic masculinity. This is not protection. Exactly. This was not about Jada Pinkett. And quite frankly, wrapping with what we were just talking about, we just saw what protecting Black women can look like with Cory Booker, where he uplifted her and spoke to her and filled her up.
Right.
I'm a football fan. Russell Wilson has defended his wife, Ciara, against that ex-rapper boyfriend Future for years and never laid a hand on her.
Never laid a hand. Right.
So let's stop rationalizing this bad behavior. And because what it speaks to is that as much as we live in a patriarchy where men are a danger to women, it can be violent and terrible, we unfortunately still have some women who romanticize toxic masculinity if they think it's in defense. And we should be against toxic masculinity regardless of who the victims are. It is never a good idea. Nothing that Will Smith did is okay.
Malcolm, you know, you retweeted Don Lou 87, and in which he said, Will Smith didn't just steal from his own moment tonight. He stole from Venus Williams, Serena Williams, Richard Williams, and everyone else involved with King Richard. Shame. Tell us how that struck you, because that I agreed with that tweet. It struck me as something at the core, the most profound and sad part of that was it wasn't about you, Will.
Yeah.
And you made it about you.
What I found most striking is, first off, I hadn't seen the film King Richard, but the moment I saw that tweet, I remembered what it was about.
Right.
And it was all long forgotten, right? Because of what he did. I completely purged that movie from my mind because of what he did. Even when he won the Oscar, I forgot about that. And I thought, oh my God, you not only trampled on, you know, the honor of the woman who you were supposedly defending, insulted all, you know, made African-Americans into a movie, caricature on international television.
Yep.
All right. You also destroyed the story of two young women who overcame anything and became global champions, you know, all in the trash. Then he walked. And then here's the kicker. The dumbass won an Oscar. Do you think he could have just shut his mouth and said, I got to give this 20 minutes because I may have won an Oscar? Right. No. He couldn't do it. Look, we're from the same-ish neighborhoods in Philly, right? Overbrook. Mm-hmm. I'm actually from Winfield, which is about a block away from Overbrook. We're the genteel people. So, and maybe that one bridge, the one bridge over the train track between Overbrook High School and St. Barbara's Elementary School, where I went, I was raised on the concept of chivalry, a phrase which means the defense of honor, but not murderous defense of honor, right?
Right.
Where, you know, where you can take an insult, where you can have a conversation, where that could have been hashed out later to without having to degrade not just Chris Rock, not just, you know, the defense of his wife, but to degrade all Black men. So here I am, other side of the world, people are dying in droves over here by the hundreds per day, where blood literally runs throughout the street. And what does BBC have to break in for? To talk about how serious a situation it was between Will Smith and Chris Rock. And I'm thinking, I don't believe that I am in this crazy world where this is a story about anything. And they were talking like he had done it to the queen. You know, I mean, it was, here's the stories that were on. Massacres in Mariupol. All right, that was one. Counteroffensives northwest of Kyiv and the city of Lviv being bombarded. That was two. And Will Smith apologize to Chris Rock? We have it here on BBC Live. And I'm thinking, this is the stupidest story in the history of mankind. And what do I got? Two African Americans ruining it for everybody.
Yeah,
right.
Making it. There are children in effing Norway right now in Trondheim going to school wondering, well, is he going to apologize? No, this is so stupid. I have this phrase when I was in the military, focus, right? Put my hands up, right?
That's it.
The blade head, we're about to slap you, focus. Well, if I could have said that to the world, I would have. Because I'm almost embarrassed.
Yeah.
But yes. I think another component of it is a good part of the world was like, yeah, we could use this break from the massacre.
Well, that's probably true too, Jason.
I feel like, you know, there's a different, I compare this, and I want to be very careful about this comparison, but the reaction from the Black community sort of here domestically was akin to sort of the day after a really bad court ruling where some cop gets off, like nobody worked on Monday. Everybody's conversation, every class was canceled. Every interview that I had that was like, yeah, so today we're going to be talking about Jane. Oh no, no, we're talking like it absolutely enveloped everybody's existence because
even the Russians heard about it.
Right. Because these are two beloved public figures, like global icons, really, yeah, who really haven't gotten into any kind of trouble. Chris Rock has been a stand-up comedian for 30-something years, right? And has never gotten into any kind of trouble. Has never had
his wife. He's dogged Jada quite a bit.
Over
the last 6 years, the last three or four Oscars, he
made the joke about her a couple years ago.
Yeah, there's a little bit more history there in that regard than not.
But I still think, again, it still goes back to toxic masculinity because one, toxic masculinity and actually respectability politics, because we jump back. Okay, so Chris Rock makes a joke about her 5 years ago, 6 years ago, whatever. Okay, it's bad. I mean, we're trying to believe that in the subsequent 6 years that Chris Rock and Will Smith have never been in a room together, that this has been simmering for 5 years. Come on. Like, we know that's not the case. The other thing is, and I think this is excruciatingly important, is that Will Smith, and I'm just going to say this as a guy, not trying to be toxic, right? But it's like, not only do I think Will Smith doesn't do that to a Bill Burr or a Ricky Gervais. You know what? Will Smith doesn't do that to Dave Chappelle.
No.
Okay. That's a long walk up that stage.
Oh, no.
That's a long walk.
They'd be throwing down in the streets, those
exactly.
two.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
He doesn't do that.
You don't want to do that. Look, Chappelle, Will may be Philly.
Right.
But Chappelle is DC.
Exactly.
We roll.
Ain't no question. Ain't no question.
Question
so,
there.
So let's not pretend that this was some act of spontaneous, I can't control myself. You had a lot of thinking to do as you walked up that stage and you knew exactly who you were dealing with. You know who you can do this to. You know who you can't do this to. If Will Smith had decided, and this is the context, like I said, I mentioned Scarlett Johansson. If Eric Benet had marched up on stage and punched Adrian Brody when he kissed his wife back in 2003, you remember Adrian Brody grabs Halle Berry? Everybody would have said it was terrible. If it was 50 Cent on stage and made a joke about T.I. and his wife Tiny, everybody would have said, oh my gosh, look at these Black rappers and their nonsense, their lack of self-control. The privilege, the oozing level of privilege that is demonstrated by being able to walk on stage, smack another man on global television and return to your seat and continue talking smack, knowing full well that you're not really going to face any consequences, I can't empathize with that kind of energy. I can't empathize with that kind of toxicity. Yeah. And while I don't think that Will Smith is a terrible person, this is a big mistake. I don't think my opinion of neither of these guys has changed fundamentally. I do think that we need to very much as an internal community examine what our notions of masculinity are and address some of these people out there who have had so little experience with functional love in their own lives, men and women, that they think that this is an act of love.
Well, my view, fellas, as we wind this conversation down, and it's killing me to have to do it, but I gotta let you go fight a war, and you gotta go.
I got class.
You
I got
class. Like is this you don't get to slap a brother on the stage, go back to your seat, talk smack, win an Oscar, get a standing ovation, and then go up and talk about being a vessel of love. It just doesn't happen in anybody's world. It just said to me that it was a sad commentary on the state of where we are culturally in this country, that something like that could happen and people could see it as an act of love. So that's all. Look, fellas, I want to thank you guys. You guys are looking good. The trim seems to be working. Malcolm, you ready to go do business, baby? We got you all trimmed up very nice. Appreciate you brothers coming out and being a part of the barbershop conversation here on the Michael Steele podcast. Everybody, you know the deal. Check us out on the Spreaker app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts on. Check these brothers out on Twitter. You want to follow Malcolm at Malcolm Nance and Jason at Dr. Jason Johnson. They got good stuff that they're posting out there. You can keep up with them. And of course, follow me at Michael Steele. Until next time, be safe, be well, take care. And if you like this episode, please comment on the Spreaker app. It helps me know what you're thinking and what you're feeling so I can bring you better programming. All right, until next time, folks. Later.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.